John Lear is a retired airline captain, former CIA pilot, as well as the son of the famous inventor of the Lear Jet. He is a Lockheed L-1011 captain and is highly regarded in aviation circles. He has flown more than 150 test aircraft and has won every award granted by the Federal Aviation Administration. John also holds 18 world speed records and has worked for 28 different aircraft corporations. And during the late 1980s into the early 1990s, John began coming forward with startling revelations concerning the subject of aerial phenomena and unidentified flying objects. He is our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. John, my pleasure. How are you?
George, it's an honor and a pleasure to be on the show with you, and I'm great.
The disclosure briefing that I just heard that I played, is that based on things that are or things that could be?
Most of that was real. In fact, all of it was real. There was if I had to make a change, I'd make the change, which isn't important, about why they killed Kennedy. There are so many reasons they killed Kennedy, but one of the main thing, the reason they killed Kennedy, he was insisting on inspections of Dimona, which was Israel's nuclear manufacturing plant, and they couldn't have that, and so Mossad, in conjunction with several guys at CIA, one of which was, I'm trying to think of his name. Anyway, they got together and they planned that thing and eliminated Kennedy.
You
know, there's a few things that they left out in that briefing for Art. And one of them was that EBE-3, who was captured in 1953, who they named J-Rod, helped them build their own flying saucers, the United States government.
Is that the one that that Dan Bursch person is talking about?
I've seen those tapes, and at first I thought that Dan Bursch stuff was not real until I saw the videotapes of him, and I said, yes, that's real. He was there. I know the protocol, and he was there, and the stuff that he says is real. And later in the program, I'll tell you, some of the stuff that he is going to be talking about is not, it's disinformation, but basically that's not his fault. By 1962, we had vehicles, while they could not perform the faster-than-light speed of the alien vehicles, we could certainly get them to the moon in about an hour. Regular trips to Mars, we were making regular trips to Mars in 1966. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo were all cover missions, and most of the astronauts knew it. And on January 27, 1967, a fire in Apollo 1 atop the spacecraft, I think it was Pad 39A, killed Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, and one other astronaut. But this fourth astronaut was not one that we knew. The fourth guy was one of the secret astronaut corps that was formed along with the astronaut corps that we knew about. The difference being that the astronauts in the secret corps were going to the moon in 1962 while the public was watching the Mercury astronauts circle the globe.
Oh, really?
And after constructing various buildings and mining facilities by 1966, we landed on Mars. Since then, we have explored most of the planets in our solar system and found life similar to us on all of them. Now, one interesting thing, George, remember Mars Rover a few years ago had the dust settle on the solar panels and it couldn't recharge its battery?
Right, it looked like it was going to die, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the dust was gone. And the batteries recharged and everything was normal.
Right, and they blamed some kind of wind dust devil that knocked it off or something.
Well, what really happened was that was our secret astronaut corps up there with paper towels and Windex.
John, you believe that one?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the guy that told me that, who is not living anymore, when I had expressed disbelief in some of the stuff, or, you know, not expressed disbelief, I said, you know, are you sure this is true? And he told the Mars Rover story. He said, yeah, that's who went up and cleaned it.
Why would... All right, here, let me ask you this, John. And we're going to get into a lot of interesting things with you tonight. And you've got credentials all the way down your arm, and I want everybody to understand that, because I'm going to ask you some specifics of your life. I want them to understand who you are, who we're talking to tonight. Why would they even need rovers there if we had astronauts already on the planet?
It's part of the cover-up. Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, the space shuttle, it's all to keep our eye on that while the other stuff is going on.
A huge, bigger picture, no doubt.
Huge, huge, bigger picture.
All right, let's talk a little bit about John Lear. Of course, you know, the son of the famous inventor of the Learjet. I don't know if anybody's ever asked you, John, about your father and how he even came about inventing this jet. That I'd like to know.
Well, in 1930, he formed what was known as Lear Incorporated, and he built millions and millions of dollars of equipment for the armed services. They were in the form of actuators, crew jacks, fuel pumps, all kinds of stuff. And in 1956, he wanted to improve an airplane, which was a Lockheed Lodestar. And he took the Lockheed Lodestar, put more powerful engines on it, cleaned up the wings, retracted the tailwheel, did a lot of other things, and it became known as the Learstar. They sold 62 of those airplanes as executive airplanes. But the program was not successful. There were several major accidents, one of which killed Mike Todd over there in Grants, New Mexico, and one which killed the entire board of Johnson & Johnson Company, and it was not successful. In 1958, he wanted to design a brand new airplane, and oddly enough, the new airplane was going to be a pusher type airplane, but it developed into the Learjet. And at that time, you know, they say that he was the first. He wasn't the first. They had the Sabreliner and the Jetstar, the North American
right.
Sabreliner and the Lockheed Jetstar, and he came along and he started building the Learjet. He went to his board of directors. And they said, no, Bill, we're not going to go along with this. It's not going to go, and you're not going to spend our money. So he sold his stock in Lear Incorporated to Siegler Corporation. It became known as Lear Siegler. And he took that money, $7 million, and started what was known as the Swiss American Aviation Corporation in Geneva, Switzerland. The reason he moved to Geneva, he thought there was availability of engineering talent, availability of raw stockpile materials, and that he could get the airplane built there. But after a disastrous 3 years in 1963, he moved to Wichita, Kansas, built a plant there, and continued the design and production of the Learjet there.
The rest history. Did he ever know Howard Hughes? I would bet Hughes would have been all over him to get those jets.
No, he knew Howard Hughes. They had a big beef, and it's my understanding that the problem started with Howard borrowed an airplane from Dad and left it somewhere out of gas and never told him where it was. And forever after, they were not so much enemies, but didn't talk to each other.
All right, tell me a little bit about John Lear. I mean, because you grew up then in the aviation industry, and it obviously had a lot to do with the direction that you took.
Well, I grew up in Santa Monica, California, went to Santa Monica High. I used to spend all my time out at the Santa Monica Airport. It just irritated my dad to no end because he didn't like pilots, oddly enough. He was a pilot himself.
That is interesting.
But he didn't like pilots, and he didn't like me getting into aviation, although he did provide the airplanes. There was a Bonanza and an Aero Commander out there, and I used to fly them around, got my private, then my commercial, then my instrument. And I used to hang around at the Santa Monica Tower and work the B position and then A position, just as a kid in high school. And it was a lot of fun, and that's all I wanted to do. As a matter of fact, in 1960, after I graduated from high school, I was in his office there that was on 3171 South Bundy, and he called in the plant psychiatrist, and the guy's name was Plass, P-L-A-S-S. And he said, John, I want you to talk to Mr. Plass here. He said, about your hopes and desires. And he was actually having me evaluated by the plant psychiatrist. So we go off in another room, and I talk with this guy. He says, what's going on with you and your dad, gone. I said, well, I want to be an airline pilot. You know, that's what I want to do. I love to fly airplanes, you know. Dad wants me to be an attorney or a doctor, and he says I can earn enough money to buy my own airplane. I don't want my own airplane. I just want to fly an airplane. And Dad says that that's just like being a bus driver. And I said, well, you know, so what's wrong with being a bus driver? So anyway, we go back into Dad's office, and Dad said, well, did you guys get straightened out? And Plath says, well, Mr. Lear, I think he has some pretty good ideas for what he wants to do. Dad threw us both out of the office there.
Well, it was a love, Ed, because yeah, just by reading some of the writings you've done, John, and your background, it followed you all your life into different facets as well. I mean, ending up as a pilot for the CIA. Would you do it again today? If today's CIA said, hey, John Lear, we need some help, would you fly for them?
No, it's different today.
It is.
Everything's different today. I've been retired 5 years since May of 2000 when Kittyhawk International went bankrupt. I was flying the L-1011 for them. And, you know, I had took all my licenses. I had them laminated and framed, put on the wall so I would never be tempted to use them again. I canceled all my aviation subscriptions. And you know what, George? I don't even look up in the sky anymore. When I flew, and I've talked to a lot of friends that flew when I was flying in the 60s and 70s and 80s. I flew in the best of times. I flew the greatest equipment and flew the most interesting missions. But it's not like that anymore. In those days, we knew who the good guys were and who the bad guys were.
Right.
And these days, you don't. You don't even dare get in the business because you don't know who the good guys and bad guys
are. And I bet you knew all those. You knew the Jaegers. You knew everybody. During this era.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, while we're on that, I'd like to note the untimely passing of Scott Crossfield, who was killed a few weeks ago.
That's right. He was a giant. He was a giant
of mine,
in the business.
In a weather-related crash in a Cessna 210, Scott flew the Douglas D-558 Skyrocket to Mach 2, and he also became the first man to exceed Mach 2 and flew the X-15 to Mach 2.97. Now, I want us to set the record straight tonight, George, on who really was the first pilot to exceed the speed of sound and level flight. Chuck Yeager has always been reported to be the first,
yes.
But Chuck was less than gracious acknowledging who really was the first and less than gracious regarding other pilots' accomplishments. When Scott died a few weeks ago, Yeager made the comment that Crossfield has always taken chances. A few years ago, Yeager had this to say about the nonstop round-the-world flight in the Voyager by Gina Yeager and Dick Rutan, and I quote, "A monkey could have done it."
Oh, man.
Yeager has always been relentless in his criticism and dislike for civilian test pilots, even going so far as to say in one interview, but as airplane drivers, they really weren't as skilled as military guys. Now, remember, George, this is the same Chuck Yeager who personally crashed one of the only two Lockheed NF-104s in the aerospace training program. He not only screwed up the climb profile, this was the airplane that was built for the astronauts to test their skills in, and it also was built to go over 120,000 feet. Chuck not only screwed up the climb profile, he not only screwed up the pitch over, he screwed up the descent so badly that he had to bail out with the loss of the airplane and the termination of the program.
Right. Wasn't there a segment of him in the movie?
Yes,
was it the right stuff?
They glorified it, too.
Yeah.
Chuck should have been fired. Personally, I think a trained monkey could have done better. But the person who really broke the sound barrier for the first time in level flight was Slick Goodland, test pilot for Bell Aircraft, who built the X-1. Slick made 26 flights in the X-1 before they handed it over to the Army and exceeded Mach 1 on at least two of those flights. The Air Force, however, wanted to hog the limelight and the glory and the credit.
Okay.
So the data tapes were impounded, and General Boyd, who was head of the Flight Test Center at what then was known as Muroc, chose Yeager. And even though there were other pilots equal to or more qualified than Yeager, General Boyd picked Yeager for the Mach 1 attempt because he felt Yeager was the most expendable. Slick Goodland passed away last October, never having achieved the recognition for his achievement, mainly because of the Air Force politics.
And he just kept quiet about it.
Yep, he just kept quiet about it. And you can go on the Internet and look at Slick Goodland. There's several websites of his accomplishments.
Now, you're quite the person, John. I mean, here we are. We're going to be talking about UFOs and some incredible thoughts and theories you have about that. But you also, and I noticed this today with gold up over $720 an ounce now, you own a gold mine, don't you?
Yeah, it's in one of two certificated permitted gold mines in Clark County, and it's out in Gold Butte about 50 miles east of Las Vegas. And I love it out there because, you know, there isn't another person for 50 miles. it's high desert country, 4,600 feet. It's old Indian country. And I just love to go out there and weld and pound nails and get ready. And we're just about set to start milling in about 2 weeks.
You think you're going to hit the mother load?
Well, it's a vein, George, that runs about a mile and a half. And people have worked this vein for many years. But it has various concentrations. And we may make a little bit. But, you know, basically it's an excuse for me to get out in the open air and enjoy myself.
How old are you now, John?
63.
Oh, you're still young. You are still young.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. Now, how did you, because this started back in the 80s, how did you get interested? I mean, here you are, you know, a test pilot, airline captain. All of a sudden, you're interested in unidentified flying objects, UFOs. How in the heck did that start?
I'll tell you exactly how it happened. I was over to a friend's house across town that I knew for years and years. I was walking through his living room. On the table, there was a book called Missing Time by Bud Hopkins, and I picked this up. And I kind of thumbed through it, and I said, the guy's name was Al Newell. I said, Al, can I borrow this book? He said, sure. I took it home, and George, I don't know what came over me, but when I read that book, I said, this is real. And then shortly after that, we had a reunion of Southeast Asia pilots here in Las Vegas. And a friend of mine, Greg Wilson, who was a Raven, and you know who the Ravens were. They were the people that were taken out of the Air Force, given civilian ID, and they flew for the U.S. ambassador in Laos against the Pathet Lao and North Vietnamese. And really a gung-ho guy. And we got to talking at this reunion, and I said, you know, where all you been? Because he flew A-10s. He says, oh, different places. You know, I was over in Bentwaters. I said, Bentwaters? Well, what about that incident in 1980 where a saucer supposedly landed? He said, John, I was there. He said, I didn't see it, but I was confined to quarters, but I know the guys who did. And I thought, well, there's the second thing. And so then I just got interested and started researching. And I once took a trip throughout, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and I met all the guys that were in it. I went there and talked to them. I talked to Benowitz. I talked to Colonel Ernie Edwards. Linda Howe and I went on a trip from Albuquerque down to Roswell to talk to Clifford Stone. And when I came back, I said, man, I can't believe it. This stuff is really real. And that's when I wrote that first statement that floats around the Internet that starts out with Giordano Bruno.
Okay. Did you, because of your background in aviation, also because of your name, strong name, did that help you trying to open up doors to investigate UFOs or trying to talk to people who might not have spoken to you? Did that help?
I don't think so. I don't think I'm trying to remember of any incidents where it would. The only one that it did kind of help me is I went to research the base at Dulce. And Dulce, New Mexico. And I pulled into town driving my old GMC truck, and I checked into a hotel, and I had the name of Gabe Valdez, who was the highway patrol guy there. And I called up Gabe, and I said, my name is John Lear. I'd like to chance to meet you. He said, John, we already met. And I said, we did? And he said, yeah, 10 years ago, you flew in here in a Learjet with Dean Martin's girlfriend and a load of steaks for Dean Martin. He was shooting a movie here.
I love
the guy
it.
That met you at the airport.
I love it.
So he came over to the hotel, and his shift was 10 o'clock at night to 6 in the morning. And I spent 8 hours with Gabe Valdez, you know, in his patrol car, roaming around the mountains at night around Dulce. And I'll tell you, it was an interesting experience.
John, you've got me interested about that Apollo 1 fire. So when we come back, let's talk a little bit about that. Our special guest tonight, John Lear. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'll tell you about that song in a moment when we come back. Hey, the book that we put out with Bill Burns called Worker in the Light is available for pre-orders at Amazon.com. And the book comes out on September 19th. I'm taking part of my proceeds, and I'm going to give them back. This is me now, not through the network, to Coast listeners for the list that I've already assembled. And I know it's taking a little long, but hold on. The book comes out in a few more months. But those of you who want to take advantage of the pre-order at a substantial discount, you can go now to Amazon.com. You put in the search section book, and then either my last name or Worker in the Light. Hey, John, I've got to ask you about that bumper song we played by the Byrds, 242 Foxtrot. Was that you in the background I heard?
That's me, and Mylon Haven was the co-pilot. And I got to tell you a funny story.
Sure.
Cigar Aficionado magazine in October of 2003 made a big, lavish story with many pictures. It was 7 pages long about the 40th anniversary of the first flight of the Learjet. Now, I read this story, and I'll tell you, for a magazine like Cigar Aficionado, I can't believe there was not one single fact in that story that was correct. And I wrote Marvin Chankin and asked him about it. Of course, never heard about it. But just let me read you
Sure. What
they wrote about. They interviewed Roger McGuinn, who was with the Byrds, and they said, well, you know, what was it like flying with John Lear? And I'm quoting from Roger in the magazine article. He says, John once gave us a ride from Los Angeles to Pensacola for a Byrds gig. McGuinn recalls, I think it was fellow Byrds members Dave Crosby, Chris Hillman, and Gene Clark and myself, and we had Peter Fonda along. We came into Pensacola at too high an altitude, and John did a maneuver called a split S to get down. I was sitting in the cockpit with him, and John was just a kid like us. He liked to go fast. He explained that the split S to me was a steep dive that would have us coming out upside down at the bottom. I'm agreeing with him, and I'm saying, you better tell the guys back there to buckle up. Well, says McGuinn, who was feeling a bit ornery that day, I didn't bother. The daring maneuver in the Learjet 24 left the passengers in the rear a little spooked, but otherwise unhurt. They could thank the man who created the Learjet in the first place for the plane's dexterity in tight situations, which has always been one of its attractions. Now, George, can you imagine a magazine like Cigar Aficionado printing a story like this about a guy who's flying Part 121, you know, airlines? I mean, it was just
strange.
Okay, so as a gag, I wrote Clay Lacy, who I was working for Clay Lacy Aviation at the time, and, you know, this was back in 1966. And so October 5th, 2003, I said, Dear Clay, if you haven't seen the latest issue of Cigar Aficionado, I am closing an excerpt. I have kept this incident secret for many years, but now that it is all over the newsstands and I am retired, I can finally tell the truth. First of all, we really were late letting down into Pensacola. Hell, we were 30 miles past it, but I'm getting ahead of myself. First of all, since I was going to try and make it nonstop from Van Nuys to Pensacola, I had taken the inspection plates off the front part of the tip tanks and topped them off. By the time I got all the Byrds guitars and stuff loaded, I was really beat. We were so heavy that I leveled off at 37,000, set .77 on the autopilot, and asked center for block 37,000 to 41,000. Of course, this was back in the old days when it was pretty easy to do. I was letting each of the band members sit for a little while in the right seat. When it was Dave Crosby's turn, he offered me a toke. Normally, I try not to smoke dope while I'm on duty, but it happened to be some incredible Maui Wowie, and I thought, what the hell? It will probably wear off in the 3 remaining hours of the flight. The flight went great. Everybody was having a good time, singing and laughing and telling jokes, until I became vaguely aware that center was calling and asking if I wanted descent. Here I was at 60,000 feet. The airplane was at 41,000 feet, and it turns out we were 30 miles past Pensacola. I thought the best way to reverse course and lose altitude was to do a split S. So I asked center for lower and permission to reverse course, which they approved. Unfortunately, in all the excitement and the fact that I was still a little foggy, I started the split S but forgot the half roll at the top. What I had done, in fact, was the first half of an outside loop, which is why I ended up upside down at the bottom of descent. Of course, I told McGuinn that this was the way it was done, and he didn't know anything about it anyway. I flipped the airplane right side up and landed without further incident. Of course, the rest of the guys in the back were, in fact, a little spooked. Heck, I was spooked, and I was flying the gall darn thing. But nobody was actually hurt, and I did thank Dad for making the airplane with great dexterity in tight situations to save me. Sorry you had to find out about it this way, Clay, your friend and admirer.
I love it. I love it. What did he do? What did he do when he got that?
Nothing. I called down to the guys that that knew him, and he made just one under his breath comment. He said, "That's a lot of bull."
Hey, John, there's so much to talk with you, so little time. But I want to get into your thoughts about planets and that they're inhabited. And definitely I want to talk about Apollo 1. But also, some time ago, you had an opportunity to meet Bob Lazar. I want to get your take on what you think of Bob Lazar. I mean, do you find him to be credible? Do you think he's legit?
Absolutely, 100%, 120%. What anybody ever says, you know, about Bob, disparaging Bob, I can tell you, I was the guy that was there. I was the one that he took to see the, he took me to see the flying saucer. He knew exactly when it was going to fly. He's the one that got a hold of the 115. I'm the one that saw the experiment. Him and Joe Vaninetti and myself made the experiment.
And the 115 being the element that
the powers the saucers.
The powers the saucers, okay.
And what we did is we took a bell jar and we put a piece of dry ice and we put the 115 on the dry ice, then took a Coleman lantern, one of those little, what do they call them, the little lantern panels or whatever they are that... shines light, and these are partially radioactive.
The reflectors?
Yeah, they are partially radioactive, and they're the ones that cause the light in the lantern to be so bright.
All right.
And they shoot out alpha rays. Now, the alpha rays are supposed to go out into space at, you know, the speed of light, but we have videotape of that, you know, the alpha rays being, you know, pulled back down into the 115. So, you know, the bottom line is Bob was real. You know, the whole incident was real. Everything happened exactly as Bob said it did and I said it did. I've seen the Dan Burrish tapes. As far as I know, he never met Bob, but the stuff that he talks about certainly indicates that S4 is real and that it's there.
And to some people who do not know who Bob Lazar is, he was a self-styled nuclear physicist. He worked at the S4 test site, which is very close to Area 51 in Nevada, back in, I guess, 88 to 89.
88 and 89. I met him the summer of 88, and he came over here with Gene Huff, and Gene Huff was a real estate appraiser. And Gene had called me on the phone, and he said, you know, I've heard about all your stuff. I'd like to get some of your tapes. And at that time, you know, I had just been totally swamped with people that want something, and I wasn't too interested. And he said, I'm a real estate appraiser. And at that time, I was looking for to get my house refinanced. I said, okay, I'll tell you what. If you come over and appraise my house, I'll give you all the stuff I had. So he came over, and the guy that was holding the helping him hold the tape to measure the rooms was this guy, Bob Lazar.
He was helping the appraiser?
Yeah. And so we sit down and talk, and we're talking about UFOs, and Bob is rolling his eyes, and he says, look, I have to tell you guys, I worked at Los Alamos. I had the highest clearance you can get. And he said, if there was anything like this, I would have known. This is all pure BS. Well, over the next 4 months, and that would have been July, August, September, November, October, we gave Bob some information that he could check out with his friends at Los Alamos.
Right.
One was the existence of the YY-2 facility, which was really secret. Now, we were told that that was where EDE-3 was kept. But whether he's kept there or not, the fact was that Bob found out that, yes, that place did exist. And a number of other things he found out, and he decided to reenter the scientific community. And that's when he called Dr. Teller, and I was there when he called Dr. Teller. And he said, I'd like to reenter the scientific community. And Teller says, do you want to work at in Las Vegas or do you want to work at Lawrence Livermore with me? And Bob said, I want to work at Area 51. And Teller said, well, let me see what I can do. And so then a few days later, Bob gets a phone call from some guys at EG&G. And he went over and over a period of 2 or 3 weeks got 3 security interviews. And on the second security interview, and of course, he told us all what they asked him. The first question was, do you know John Lear and what's your opinion of him?
Interesting.
And he said, yes, I know John Lear, and I believe he sticks his nose in places where it doesn't belong. And Bob said, what I didn't tell them is I also like to stick my nose
in
places
exactly.
It doesn't belong. So then the first thing, you know, the next thing I heard is I think it was around December 6th of 88. He's sitting in front of my desk here one evening, and he said, I saw a disc today. And I said, what? He said, I saw a disc today. And I said, you went up to Area 51? He said, yeah. And I said, then what are you doing here? I said, they're probably following you. Why don't you find out what's going on and then come back and tell me? He says, no, John, you've taken so much flack over this stuff. I want to tell you that I saw it and it's real. And that's how the whole thing started.
Oh, my God. How did he describe the craft to you?
He said that he walked in the hangar. They let him in. He's always had two guards, one on each side. They let him through the hangar door, or the hangar door was open. And he said he walked by it, and he saw an American flag, and he thought, well, this is what, this explains it. This is just stuff that we have. And he said he put his hand on the disc, and he said it felt cool to the touch. And he said only later did he realize, no, this can't be ours, because when they gave him access to the inside, you know, the chairs and everything were, you know, for people that were like 3 feet tall. He said this is nothing that we could fit in.
That had to have been quite a sight for him.
It was, and it was quite an experience for me. I'll never forget those 2 years. They were the most exciting in my life. I wouldn't trade them for anything. I never thought in a million years when I started to get into this UFO business, because, you know, you just can't get any information. I never thought I'd get, you know, that close to what was really going on.
And at that point, you got to know our friend George Knapp, who is doing some fill-in hosting for us. I did an interview with George. John was several months ago, and I said, you know what, George, I'd like you to fill in for us once in a while. And he did one show for us, did a great job, and because he is such an expert at what he does, he's a perfect mix for us as a team.
Absolutely. And how George Knapp got in, it was I won't go into all that. There was three times that we went up to the test site with Bob to watch the saucers. The first one was May 22nd, 89. Then the next one was a week later. That was the one that George went and filmed. And then the last one was April 6th, a week after that. And that's when I went up with Bob, his wife's sister, and Gene Huff. And that's when security caught us. And the next day, they hauled him up to Indian Springs, which is the head of all security for the Nevada test site. And they said, now, Bob, when we gave you this clearance and showed you the flying saucers, it didn't mean you were supposed to tell all your friends about it. Now, do you want to work here or not? And he was noncommittal at that meeting, but a few days later, he decided not to go back. And the reason he told me is because the last few trips, when he went up on the 737 there, loading at the terminal, and the terminal used to be over there on Sunset, he said, John, I could remember getting on the airplane, and I could remember getting off it, but I couldn't remember anything I did up there. And he said, I didn't want to work under those conditions.
Yeah, never again.
So coincidentally, about that time was on Sunday, I had done a show with George Knapp called On the Record. And George called that evening. He said, John, we have had thousands of phone calls. What can I do for an encore? And I said, well, let me make a call. So I called Bob, and this time he had decided to quit. And I said, do you want to go and do the George Knapp news tomorrow night? And he said, yeah, as long as they don't show my face. So that famous interview of Bob was done in my driveway against the sun so they couldn't see his face.
And that was a dramatic documentary, that whole program.
Yeah, and then the next night George had Bob Stoldow come up. Bob was the head of Channel 8. And we sat around the table, and Bob, you know, asked us a bunch of questions. And George wanted to do, you know, a long six-part series. And Stoldow didn't want to go with it without being convinced. And after he talked with Bob and found out the whole story, he told George, go ahead. And that's where the six-part series came from.
You've touched a lot of lives and careers in this field. Lots of them. Apollo 1, of course, January 27th, 1967, horrible tragedy when a flash fire occurred in the command module, killing what we always thought then, John, were those three astronauts, Gus Grissom and Ed White and Roger Chaffee. But you say there was a fourth. Was he – the capsule didn't have room for four. Whereabouts would he have been?
Let me quote from the book Apollo, The Race to the Moon by Charles Murray and Catherine Blycock.
Okay.
It's an interview with Joe Shea. Joe was the head of ASPO, which was the Apollo Space Program Office. And Joe is lamenting about the fire and not being there and so on and so on. And page 223 says, for Joe Shea's The accident series achieved a dimension of tragedy. Consider the paradox in Shea's narrow escape when only a technical hitch kept him from being in the spacecraft during the fire. So lucky for him, it first seems, that they couldn't hook up the headset in time. so morbid of him, it first seems, to wish occasionally that he had been in the spacecraft after all. And yet if Shea had been in the spacecraft, he would have been sitting in the bay beneath the astronaut couches, down by the ECU, and the netting that probably first caught the fire. Now, I've got all kinds of books and drawings on Apollo, and there was plenty, not plenty of room, but they used to have a fourth guy down there that would, you know, monitor and, you know, check out things and, you know, be, you know, for various reasons during these practice countdown tests. So there certainly was room there.
Do your sources tell you that there was a fourth person there?
My source is deceased now. He was a George, a true insider, and he didn't tell me much, but he did tell me a few things, and one of them was, he said there was a fourth guy in that fire. He said I was brought in immediately afterwards. He said I went up to level 8, and he said the National Security Agency had cordoned off the area right after the fire, and they spent 45 minutes removing that body, and then they let NASA go in there and remove the rest of the bodies. And so I thought, that's pretty interesting. So I started doing research, and just one little thing after the other points to, yep, by George, there certainly was one. Now, George, this happened in 1967. You figure there might have been 30, maybe 35 controllers in that room. They were all between maybe 25 and 35 years old, maybe some older. They're between 70 and 75 now. They're still, some of them are still alive. So if they're listening to the program, I would appreciate it if you call in and say, you don't have to identify yourself, just say, yes, the story is true, I can't tell you any more than that, but there was a fourth guy. And if they want to do this, they can give me the first letter of the last name of the guy, which I know, and of course I'm not going to reveal it,
okay. But
if they'll just give me the first letter of the last name of the guy, then we'll know that that guy was there.
Okay. Well, now, if he was there, and they're covering it up, again, why would they do that? Why don't they simply say, well, we had three astronauts?
Because they would have had to explain who he was. And they would have had to explain who he was, what his background was, and he was part of the Secret Astronaut Corps, and that would have exposed the Secret Astronaut Corps. And they couldn't afford, under any circumstances, to expose the Secret Astronaut Corps.
Tell us why. Why the Secret Astronaut Corps?
Because, George, we have many things going on. As I've told you, we've been going back and forth to the moon since 1962. We've been going back and forth to Mars since 1966. We have programs going on that are unbelievable. All the rest of the stuff is cover-up. The shuttle, you know, all this stuff is just, you know, it's cover-up for what is really going on. And as hard as that is to believe, I'm hoping that sometime, someday, you're going to find out this is true.
I want to get your thoughts on that, John, when we come back at the top of the hour about what really is going on. He's got some incredible things to say. Also believes that the planets in this solar system inhabited by beings much like us. We'll get John Lear's take on that as well. John doesn't have a website, so I do not have one for you to go and take a look at. He does not have a book to sell. He doesn't have anything to sell here. He's just here to talk about some of the things that he knows that we are sharing with you tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, John Lear, much more to talk with John about. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John, I have always heard, for better or worse, that our government cut a deal with extraterrestrials for knowledge, for technology, and gave them the abductions, primarily because they figured they couldn't stop them anyway, so they might as well get something out of it. Have you heard anything like that?
Yeah, they cut the deal, and they got the technology, but they had no idea that they didn't have any, you know, that there was nothing they could do about it anyway. And they cut the deal saying, well, we'll only let you abduct this many. Well, of course, that the fact is, George, Earth is not so much of an experiment as a farm. They whoever they are, if you want to call them aliens or whatever, they use this as a farm. They harvest, they manufacture souls, and we are just containers. This information comes from the yellow book that Bob read at the test site, and that's the deal. Now, whatever they have to do to keep us in line, if they have to go to the government and say, look, we want you to help us keep our secret, and what we're going to do is give you some technology, and, of course, we'll limit our abductions. But, you know, that's just the story.
How many do you think they've taken from this planet, John?
Well, I used to say 1 in 10. I don't know whether it's any more or any less than that.
It's still a lot of people when you're talking you're talking about 1 in 10 on this planet, right?
Yeah, now they're not taking them, understand. They're just monitoring them. They take you once when you're about 3, once when you're about 7, and once when you're about 11 or 12, and then usually that's it. Now, what they do, I don't know. But that's when they just take and monitor you.
What did you mean by soul harvesting? What are they doing?
It's my opinion that that they manufacture the soul. The soul is a little electronic device that's installed in each human being as they're born, and it records all the emotion, all the senses, color, sight, sound, all that stuff, and it records all your life. And then when you pass away, when you die, that soul goes up to the moon. And there's a big, what we call the big soul machine on the moon. That's the picture that Hoagland has that came in lunar orbit 384M. I got a picture of it right in the middle of Sinus Medi. As you know, the moon is in a rotational lock. The same face points towards Earth at all times.
Right.
And right dead center is a plane called the Sinus Medi, meaning middle cavity. And right in the middle of that plane is a huge structure about 7 miles tall. It's a cube sitting on a tripod. Now, the tripod appears to be about 3 or 4 miles tall, and then the cube itself is about 1 mile on a side. And I think that's where the soul goes after you die. And then whatever they do with it, whether they send it right back, whether they wait a couple of weeks, whether they wait a couple of months, it's sent back into a newborn baby and goes through a life cycle again. Now, each one of these souls records the entire human emotion of a lifetime. The problem is for us is we can't remember that. We can't take advantage of mistakes we've made. It just keeps recording on one soul. There might be 1,000 lifetimes. Now, if you go back in history, you'll find there are people that, for some reason, don't have their memory blocked, and they can remember back several hundred years ago. I remember this lady went back to England. She remembered her entire life there. She could tell the people that were there. They went to the gravestones, the whole thing. She remembered everything, and that happens occasionally to people. But in fact, the soul records, you know, all the particular lifetimes that it's been through.
John, I know that Richard C. Hoagland has been very important to you in some of the work you've done, and so I'm bringing him online for a little bit to chat with you and us as our advisor here. We'll do a mini roundtable discussion for a little bit right now. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Hey, good evening, George.
Good. You know, Richard, I wanted you to be part of this primarily because I've always heard that you've been very important for John and some of his work and research. And years ago, when you started talking about some structures that you believed were not on just Mars, but on the moon, that I think, John, and I'll let you speak for yourself on this, how influential has Mr. Hoagland been for you?
Well, very influential. When I saw the Moon-Mars connection, I was flabbergasted. This was the most interesting thing I ever saw in my life, and that's what made me start looking for this stuff. And I happened, just by accident, to get two photos out of NASA that were unretouched. One was the north face of the crater Copernicus, and the other was a photo taken by Lick Observatory in 1947. And I want to make it clear that I do not believe that Richard believes any of this stuff about souls. that's my idea, not his. What I'm saying is Richard found that thing in the Sinus Medi and found the picture of it, which...
Well, I have a little surprise for you, John, tonight. I just earlier this evening got off the phone with my assistant, Carrie Clark, who is a photo expert in New York, and she did some of the early work on the original Apollo data that we procured out of Houston, out of the LPL, out of the Goddard National Space Science Data Center, and she has found print for you of this several-mile-high glass tower, this ruin that I found on 84M, which is one of the lunar orbiter shots taken back in, I think, 1966. So you will be getting that.
Fantastic. Exactly. You're making good on your promise that you made 4 months ago, right?
Well, she's been looking. She's been on the road, and we have this incredible archive, and we kind of distributed it around the country. You know, Steve Troy has parts of it. I have parts of it. Other people have parts of it. Carrie has parts of it. And we had to go finding, because these are all analog prints. There's nothing computerized, nothing digitized. These are the original analog images that came down from both the unmanned lunar orbiters in the 60s and as well as the Apollo Hasselblad, another film from later in the 60s in the early 70s. So you will be getting that. Now, George, I have something to announce.
Okay, go ahead.
This fall in Southern California, just about 2 hours east of Los Angeles, I'm going to be doing the first of an experimental series of retreats where we're going to have like 4 days to get people together and really go through where we are on the eve of some major breakthroughs that I think are coming. And I'm going to be revealing and publicizing and unveiling some absolutely mind-blowing lunar imagery that unquestionably answers the question that one of your callers in the first hour had, did we go to the moon? Yes, ma'am, we went, and we got the photographic proof. And, John, it is going to blow your socks off when you see what it is we found.
I can hardly wait.
And it is in color. It is corroborated. It is in the official database. It's available for anybody to go check. And it raises so many profound implications as to who has known what and when. And I appreciate that you kind of separate me from your theories as to what all this stuff means. But in terms of the evidence, gentlemen, there is no question that NASA has been hiding not only the stuff on Mars, but an extraordinary ancient set of ruins right next door on the moon. And I fully concur with John that there are two space programs. There is a secret program. There's the official program, which is the cover. And when you say, well, why would you spend $16 billion a year on a cover? Well, it's not their money. It's our money. They don't care how much they spend as long as they keep us in the dark.
Well, why don't we see those rocket ships going up for the secret program?
Because they're not rockets. George, well, come on.
What are they?
They're electrogravitic anti-gravity spacecraft that, you know, Tim Ventura and I have been discussing, which the Russians are discussing in the open literature, which are visible on the STS-80 and 48 videos that I have provided to Art, and I guess you've probably seen
yes,
them, too.
Yes, I've seen them.
Whitley, you know, used one of them, I think, on his NBC program some years ago. There's a concurrence between the two programs, but, I mean, my own intel sources, of which I have a few and they're very reliable, have unquestionably verified that there are two programs. Now, this Britisher, this Gary McKinnon, who was...
He's the computer hacker.
Yeah, who broke into NASA computers. He found years ago pilot lists, officers' lists, the squadron names, the names of their ships, all this stuff. And that's why we're throwing the book at him and we're going to give him 70 years as a lesson to anybody else. Don't do this or we'll put you away and throw away the key. And this is, I mean, this is treason. This is a national disgrace. And I'm so glad that John is on the show tonight talking about it, because the more of us that talk about it seriously and point out that there are two programs and all the astronauts risking their lives in this rat trap called the shuttle are basically doing it because they believe in God and country, and how the hell they wind up going up on that thing when there is real technology to go all over the solar system, it has to be because someone appeals to their higher patriotic purpose and they say, mankind needs you to do this. Well, mankind doesn't. These rogue groups are running the program, and even Ed Mitchell, you know, the Apollo 14 astronaut who walked on the moon, has said again and again and again that the rogue groups have taken over the programs, and they're running the show.
You agree with all this, John Lear?
Absolutely. Richard is right on, right dead center.
You know, it's pretty startling, I think, just to even imagine that this could be going on.
Well, we've had so much evidence over so many years, and the really pernicious part, George, is you got to ask yourself, you know, they used to say that the only difference between men and boys was the price of their toys.
Yeah.
These are very pricey toys. Then you have to ask the question, if they're secret and they're in the hands of people that have no accountability, and we just saw today what happens when you have government agencies running loose with no accountability, every single phone call recorded since 2001 by the NSA.
Do you believe, because I got to get into this with John soon about his belief in life on the planets in the solar system, but do you, Richard, believe that these structures on the moon may have been the ones that Ingo Swann has always said that he saw during his remote viewing episodes?
Yeah, because he saw things on the moon and on Mars. You know, and some of the things on Mars, remember, even Dame says some of the stuff on Mars is still, quote, alive, meaning it's ticking, it's technology that's still functioning. And our models cover that. You know, the hyperdimensional physics says you can produce technology that will last, you know, hundreds of thousands, not millions of years, because you're not using any known power sources. The stuff doesn't have friction, doesn't wear out, it doesn't corrode. So, yes, you can certainly envision robotic emplacements of things that are still active. We see in these photographs ruin after ruin after ruin. I mean, when you come to Joshua Tree and on the Columbus Day weekend, which is a four-day weekend, we're going to do this up really well in the desert with a lot of interesting material with enough time to go through it. I am going to show you stuff on the moon that will knock your socks off.
All right. All right. John Lear, what about the propulsion of these vehicles then? If there's this other program underway, where are they taking off from? 51?
No, the only place that I know for sure is Sandia, there north of Kirtland Air Force Base.
Look to the outback of Australia, gentlemen.
Yeah.
In the middle of a continent which has only 13 million people, and most of them are Aborigines.
Yeah.
You know, you could create entire cities, George, in the middle of Australia, and no one would ever know. But we do have reports, Aboriginal reports, of very strange things happening. That's where Pine Gap is located. Remember that facility? I think Australia is the place because it's literally on the opposite sides of the planet from 535 people who are supposed to be mining the store and have been looking the other way for 50 years.
All right, Richard. We'll get those pictures to John because I'm sure he'll love to see them.
Thanks, Richard.
All right, Richard. Thanks. Appreciate you being part of this. Well, you know, John, I guess common sense would tell you this can't be. I guess. Don't you think?
That what?
That this can't be. There can't be another program out there that's been so technologically advanced. My mind just doesn't want to believe it.
Well, let me tell you this. In 1956, my dad was heavily involved in anti-gravity research. As a matter of fact, floating around the Internet, there's a two-minute film of him giving a lecture at the Bonson Institute, and behind him is a blackboard, and he's explaining how flying saucers fly. My mother is standing next to him, and then in this two-minute film, for some reason, there's a calendar. Something is very, very important, and they're marking off the days, and then they have a picture of a lab, and they have very flimsy type tissue paper and balsa paper constructed models of flying saucers, and I don't know what that's all about, but I do know this. When in the last 35 years have you read in any technical journal, any aerospace journal, any airplane journal, anything about anti-grav? You haven't read anything, and the reason is because they've already solved it.
All I heard was when I was in St. Louis, and at one time, you know, it was the headquarters for McDonnell Douglas before they got bought out by Boeing, I had heard that they were working on some kind of anti-gravity device somewhere, maybe out on the West Coast, but that's it.
And what year was that?
That would have been about 99, I think I would have heard the story.
Well, they had all this completely solved and ready to go in the early 60s, and they've had it since then. But you're not going to see anything in Aviation Week. You're not going to see anywhere else any remotely discussing the subject of anti-grav because they've already got it.
What about the whistleblowers? How come they're not coming forward?
I'll tell you, there used to be whistleblowers, but there aren't any more, George. You know, in 1989, 1990, when I first got into this, there was guys coming from the black areas up at Area 51, and they'd knock on the door, and if I wasn't there, they'd tell my wife, they'd say, I work up in a black area. I just wanted to tell you your husband is right on. And then about 1991, it stopped. Somehow they figured out how to keep a secret. And I haven't heard a decent rumor since then.
Do you think anything happened to these people?
No, Well, maybe they did. But there was four or five of them that used to come by and give me little tidbits. But that ended in 1990, 1991, thereabouts.
And they just stay away from you now?
Oh, yeah. Somehow they've learned to keep a secret. It could be mind control, you know, whatever it is. But a secret is a secret now, and it's very difficult to find out. The only way I get information, and I had two sources. They're both dead now. They were in the program. They had been in the program forever, all their lives, and they were about to pass away. They're about to die. And I had a chance to sit down with them and talk with them.
John, have you had friends or colleagues, people who have been pilots, who have called you over the years saying, you're right on, John, we've seen things? I mean, do they come out and support you, or do they run away from you?
No, usually they don't talk about it. But just tonight, I heard a really funny story.
Would you?
There was an old cargo airline that I used to work for. It was called Rosenbaum, and they were doing a cargo flight about 1 o'clock in the morning from Chicago to Seattle. The guy who told me this was the flight engineer, Mike Tidell. And they're flying along, and they're looking ahead. They're up about 35,000 feet. They're looking ahead because air traffic control had given them FedEx, you know, 12 o'clock, 20 miles.
Yeah.
And, of course, you always look to see the airplane to be sure that, you know, the spacing is correct and everything. And they're looking ahead, and behind this FedEx, this huge circle, globe, lighted globe, comes whizzing toward them. I mean, at like 10,000 miles an hour, just when it gets between FedEx and these guys' airplanes, it heads north towards the North Pole, and they watch this thing, I mean, zip as far as the eye could see. It was huge, and as it disappeared, there was a total silence for about 5 seconds, and then the co-pilot says, now there's something you don't see every day. It was hilarious. Everybody started laughing.
I love it. I love it.
I mean, real low key. Now there's something you don't see every day.
You know, why don't you have a website, by the way?
I don't know. I just,
You don't have anything to gain here tonight, John.
No. And, you know, I'm so busy, I wouldn't have time to keep it up. And
also, there was a 10-year hiatus before you came back to talk, on Coast. And
yeah.
Over that span, why did you stay away, and then what made you come back?
Well, I don't remember exactly the reason. I think it may have been, let's see, that 10 years, I think that started in 92 or 93. I don't remember exactly what kicked it off. But you get to a point where you don't learn anymore, and then you get tired of it, and then you don't want to hear any more stories, and you just walk away. You're busy. I was busy flying. That was towards the end of my career, and I was busy with the 1011 and different airlines.
Yeah.
And one night, Art called and said, you know, man, I want you to do a show and everything. And he more or less talked me into it, and so I got back into it.
He has a way of doing that.
Yeah, he sure does.
Okay, stay with us, John. Back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, now it gets really wild. John Lear believes all the planets in the solar system are inhabited by beings much like us. We'll get his take on that. And I got to tell you, what a fast program tonight. I think we have a new propulsion system behind us. This may be one of the fastest shows I've ever participated in. Back in a moment with John Lear on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take phone calls next hour with John Lear, and one of the things John would like you to do, if perhaps you have some inside information on that Apollo 1 fire, if you want to be able to tell him some information, John believes that there might have been a fourth person involved in that horrible tragedy, and he's going to ask you to give him the initial of that person's last name. And maybe as a test to see if you really know what you're saying and if you're above board with us when you make the call. John, all planets in the solar system inhabited by beings like us?
I believe so. And let me say, not might have been a fourth guy. There was a fourth
guy.
Okay,
so you believe that entirely.
Absolutely.
All right.
And before we get too far, I just want to say hello to my friends at the Nighthawk Zone, Bad Boy, and at the Fantastic Forum, Spike, Mike, and all my friends there.
Good for you. They are great people.
Now, as far as the planets being inhabited, Mars, the population, I think, is 660 million at this time. Most of them live underground. When Bob Lazar worked up at the test site, he was shown photos of Cydonia region, very close-up photos of the Cydonia, and those pyramids had doors and windows. There was no doubt about it. I mean, it was very clear. Bob and I went down to JPL and met with the head of I'm thinking it was Mariner, but I'm not sure. I forget the guy's name. But we asked him, they said, were there any more photos taken of Cydonia other than the two ones that Hoagland and Dave Pietro have? And he said no. And then Bob said, did you ever take the spacecraft to a lower orbit? And the guy said, yes, but we didn't take any pictures. Now, here's how secrecy works. Here's the guy that's the head of the program, and he knows that it went into a lower orbit, but he didn't know that they took extra pictures. And Bob saw the extra pictures that they saw of Cydonia. That's how compartmentalization works. You might have a certain clearance, but that doesn't mean you get to know everything at that level.
Now, and I want to make sure that I understand this too, John. When we say all planets in the solar system, are you talking about just the ones that are close to Earth, or are we talking about Jupiter,
Venus,
Neptune?
Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Pluto, Mercury. Mercury is not as hot as everybody thinks it is. And I don't know whether they live above ground, but I believe that there's people from each one of these. And we're fed so much BS. You know, there's so much methane that NASA puts out. You know, I think they generate the methane themselves that they say that all these planets are covered with. But it's just a scam. It's a ruse so that we don't think that there's any, that we're the only ones there. But there certainly are people on Venus. There certainly are on Mars. Interesting thing, I did a remote viewing class. I went to a class with Angela Thompson-Smith, and it was very interesting. I was shocked. I went to the remote viewing course because I was interested in it, but what I wanted to know is I'm not the least bit psychic. I can't tell when the phone's going to ring. I can't tell when the doorbell's going to ring. I don't know when anything's going to happen. I wanted to see if I could do it, and I'm telling you, George, after the second day, some of the stuff I was doing absolutely shocked me.
Sure.
But at one point, each member of the class got to task the other members into doing something or going somewhere. So I tasked the group when it was my turn to go to Venus. Now, I didn't front-load them with anything, any of my ideas or anything, just said, you know, the target is Venus. And so then there was the normal cool-down period. Then they go, then they come back, then cool-down again. And then the thing right out of their mouth was every single one of them said, my gosh, that's beautiful. I had no idea, you know. And then one of them said, boy, that's like South Africa. You know, it was green and beautiful and just all kinds of, you know, beautiful scenery there. It's not like, you know, the sulfuric acid covered 90 bars of pressure, volcanic spewed. I think that came about in the late 50s when it was decided that we should not know that there's anybody on Venus. And I can imagine a general sitting around with his staff and saying, now, folks, gentlemen, we have to make Venus as unpalatable as possible. I need some ideas here. And so one guy says, well, how about we make the atmosphere sulfuric acid? Great, great. That's good. Let's have some more ideas here. Well, how about we make
it's too hot.
How about we make it to all volcanic lava? Great, great. Come on. Let's think outside the box here. Come on. Let's hear some more ideas. Well, how about we make it 100 bars of pressure? And the general says, nah, 100 bars sounds a little phony. How about 90 bars? And they says, yeah, okay, that's good. We got a planet here. Now what else? And they said, they probably said, well, why don't we say that everybody that prints a picture of Venus, we use the false color of gold or yellow. That'll get everybody to thinking, you know, that it's molten lava. And that's exactly what happened. Now we're supposed to believe all that? I can't believe it. How did the Venera land? Did the parachute, you know, landing and floating a parachute down at 90 bars of pressure would be like floating a parachute in the ocean. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Why, John, with my very open mind, and it is, and you've heard the program, and you know I have an open mind about a lot of things, why can't I accept this, that there are other humans or beings much like us on planets in our solar system? I'm just holding back on that.
It's just too much to accept. And, you know, it takes years, you know, to get into this stuff. And I can tell when I talk to a person, I'm so tempted to tell them everything I know. And I can tell the instant that I've gone too far because their eyes glaze over. And you can tell, oh, that's it. That's as far as he's going to go. And the mind just shuts down. They don't want to hear it. They just can't accept it anymore. And the only reason it's easy for me to accept is I've been in it so long. And I've seen so many things happen, and, you know, absolutely nothing surprises me. I was just taking a check on some of the forums on the Internet, and the big soul machine on the moon, which we refer to as the tower that Richard found, I mean, that shuts a lot of people down. They just disappear. They don't want to hear that. It's just too far out for them.
Well, we've got this new fast blast system that we've had for a couple of years, and it gives me instant feedback from people, so I've got some questions that I can roll off for you from some of our listeners as well. And then next hour, we'll just open up the phone lines for you, John.
And sounds good. And then briefly, George, I just want to say that on the Fantastic Forum last September, I posted a thread called I Intend to Expose NASA's Biggest Lie. And that thread, in a period of less than 3 months, attracted 65,000 views.
Oh.
And what I did is, instead of just telling him what the lie was, I made him research the information that led me to find out what the lie was. And I made him research Neil Armstrong's speech at the White House, 25th anniversary. I made him research the neutral point between the Earth and the Moon. I made him research Alan Bean's comment that the sky was as black as a pair of black patent leather shoes. I made him research Edgar Mitchell's comment that he just can't remember what happened on the moon, all that stuff. And at the end, I tell exactly what the biggest lie was, and the biggest lie was that the sky is not black on the moon during the daytime. It's blue.
Just like it is here.
Yep, just like it is here, just like it is on Mars.
Huh.
The sky is blue on Mars. It's not red.
I've always heard that when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, he saw huge alien craft on the other side of a crater.
He did, and the closest he ever came to acknowledging that, you know, Neil Armstrong's only made about 3 speeches since he came back.
Yeah, he had a little conference a few months ago, but you're right.
And I wanted to tell you something. There's a very interesting notation in a book here, and the book is called The Moon Landings. And it's by Reginald Turnell. And on page 239, there's a very interesting sentence. And it talks about Neil and just before they blast off. And it says, quote, "He may have had in mind the 12 men already sealed inside the lunar receiving laboratory, ready to share with the crew their strict 21 days isolation, starting from the moment when it was hoped they would lift safely off from the moon." Now, think about that. We never heard about 12 guys in the lunar receiving laboratory. Who were those guys? Those were the guys that told Neil and Buzz and Michael that they weren't going to tell what they saw, you know, on the moon. And it probably spent 21 days, and there was probably some fisticuffs going on. But whatever happened there, Neil never said anything other than he did the one talk after they got out of the lunar receiving laboratory.
And that was it for years.
At the 25th anniversary, and he did the one at 60 Minutes. And
right.
Basically what happened is when he was just, you know, a couple hundred feet from landing, there was a couple of saucers right there. And he had to, he couldn't pull up, but he actually extended where he was going to land so none of the cameras got the pictures of the saucers there. And I thought it was really interesting on 60 Minutes. When they're interviewing, I think it was Mike Wallace, and he brings this up. He didn't have to bring that up. He could have brought up anything else, but he said, yeah, that field of boulders was really big. And for those of us that know, you know, what that field of boulders was, you know, with a field of boulders, a bunch of saucers. And he had to go to a little place a little farther under, and that's why he burned so much fuel.
One of the keys to all of this, to this entire theory of why they're not telling us, why they're withholding, I think it was buried when Wernher von Braun died. When Werner passed on, I think he knew a lot of things, may have told some people. Did you hear anything, John, about him?
No, I've read that he was at Roswell. And interestingly enough, before I ever got involved in this UFO stuff, which I told you was 1985,
right.
When I was flying for an airline called Air Club International, I had a trip to Bahamas, and we were there for a couple of days, and I signed up. I had a scuba diving card, and I signed up for a dive, and guess who my dive partner was?
Von Braun.
Von Braun. Now, you know, I wish I'd have known, you know, enough then to ask him some questions, just like, you know, my dad died in 1978. He used to talk about saucers, but not that much. And it turns out he was right in the middle of it. I mean, he was on the board of Lovelace Clinic. Randy Lovelace was the Air Force surgeon that was transferred from Wright-Patterson to Albuquerque in 1947. And Lovelace Clinic was the place where they did a lot of the autopsies, or many of the autopsies. My dad was close to Jimmy Doolittle. Jimmy Doolittle was wrapped up in this thing. The former head of second head of the CIA, I'm trying to think of his name, and he was part of MJ-12. He had a crush on my mom. These guys were all around the house.
Was that Alan Dulles?
No. It was, now I'll remember the name. I'm getting into Alzheimer's here, and I can't recall anything.
Of course, you know, the guy who jumped out of a window was Forrestal.
Forrestal. And okay. But anyway, all those guys were around the house. If I'd have known anything then, it would have been great. I would have loved to ask him some questions, but I didn't get interested until 1985.
Where does this all lead us, John? What's going to happen? I mean, are we going to ever get disclosure, or what?
I thought no. Up, you know, when I did that Art Bell disclosure thing, I was firmly against it. And now I've heard some of the stuff that Dan Burrish has come out with, and an associate of, somebody who did the videos, a guy named Ron Garner, and he showed me some of those videos and told me some of this stuff. And it appears like MJ-12, which now apparently has 36 members, wants the information out, but they don't know how to do it. And they want the information out, but they want to put their spin on it. In other words, when I say that we're just an experiment, that it's a farm, it's harvest, they don't want that story. They'll go ahead and admit that J-Rod is from Zeta Reticuli 2,
and he's
but
here.
Their story is the story that if you've read anything about Project Serpo, that spin. And that spin is, yeah, Zeta Reticuli is hot. Yeah, they play soccer. Yeah, they tell time with a sundial. But you wouldn't want to go there because they don't eat the stuff that we do. And they have families in this, you know, and that's all there is to it. And, of course, that's a spin. That's not the truth. And the way that you spin something is use a little bit of the truth and a little bit of what you want people to believe. The fact is they do come from Zeta Reticuli too. But they don't have families. They don't reproduce. They're cybernetic organisms. They're stamped. They're robots. They're here to carry on the experiment, which is somebody else's experiment.
What do you think of this Serpo group, where they claim that we sent astronauts in an exchange program with extraterrestrials?
We sent astronauts, but not 12 of them. We sent 3 of them, and that part of the story is true.
Did they come back?
Three came. Let's see. Two came back, one was crazy, one was normal, and one was dead. And I don't remember whether the dead one came back or they left him there.
And these
at least
are,
that's the story.
These are Americans.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the Serpo website, which had been down for about a month, is back up again. And it is as bizarre as anything I've seen, John.
Yeah, that's the spin.
Is there a lot of disinformation out there?
All of it is disinformation. I mean, you hardly can get any true information. For instance, the other day somebody said, hey, I heard it. Somebody told me that 80% of the saucers that the public sees are ours. And I said, yeah, they are. I said, you know, we've had them. We've been developing it since 1960. I mean, we've had it since, you know, all of those things are ours. There's a few of them that are alien saucers, but most of them are ours.
Most of them are ours.
Yeah.
But we were given the technology. We didn't come up with it on our own.
No, I think, and we weren't given, like I said, we don't have the stuff that can go, you know, hundreds of times faster than the speed of light, because that has technology that Bob Lazar worked on for Dr. Teller, and what they were trying to do is figure out if we could duplicate it any way, and we can't. I mean, you take element 115 and a little chunk of it, an arrowhead chunk of it, pump in protons, bump it up to 116, there's an annihilation, and the annihilation throws off two things, the gravity A wave and antimatter. The antimatter is mixed with matter to create heat in a thermionic generator to create power for the craft, and then the gravity A wave is siphoned off to use for the gravity generators, which pulls it through space. And that stuff that, so far ahead, we don't have a hope of being able to duplicate that stuff. We just don't have the materials.
Element 116, Unonhexium. I know that one.
Okay.
That's the only one I know.
Okay, Unimpenium is the 115. And if you pump a proton into Unimpenium, which is stable, it makes it 116. 116 is unstable, and it decays. And when it decays, it's a total annihilation, and it throws off two things, the gravity A wave and antimatter.
Are other governments part of this, or is it just us?
A lot of them are. We're closest to the Canadians on this. And as I, you may remember the story I told Art Bell years ago, the guy that came to my house, and he was Air Force photographer stationed in Honolulu, and he got TDY temporary duty assignment to Norton. When he got to Norton, he was put in a limo with the windows blacked out and taken somewhere near 29 bombs, and it went down in an elevator. The car went down in an elevator. He got out. They told him to change in this change room. He put on a smock, a cap, and booties, and they gave him a camera, and he walked into this hangar, and there was a ladder up to a saucer, which was maybe about, he says, 40 feet in diameter. He went up the ladder, and he said he poked his head inside to put the camera in there, and he said, John, he said, I couldn't believe it. He said, when I poked my head inside, I could have thrown a football and not hit the edge of the saucer. He said it was so big.
Gosh.
And he said, I stepped back out on the ladder to see if this thing was really, you know, like 40 feet, which wasn't all that big. And it's 40 feet. And he said, I poked my head back in, and he said it had to be 200 feet to the edge of the thing. And he said one of the scientists, he had a Canadian accent, said, come on, guy, we've got to, you know, get some pictures here. And so he went in and he took pictures as they put their hands over consoles, and it would go down and go up and that kind of stuff.
I sometimes think we're on the verge of breaking the biggest story of all mankind, John. I mean, it's there for us.
It could be. I mean, I don't know. It'd be interesting.
Stay with us. We're going to take phone calls now next hour in this rapid program. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast with our special guest tonight, John Lear. Well, I don't know why we gave the phone numbers. The lines are already jammed. We'll be back in a moment. John Lear, our guest, will take your phone calls on our next Coast to Coast program. By the way, tomorrow night will be our Friday into Saturday night open lines. But for the first hour, I'm going to talk with someone by the name of Anonymous about that very strange box called the Dybbuk box. So get ready for that one. But we'll be back in a moment. John Lear, your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Did you ever come across anything, John, which would show that during this episode with extraterrestrials that there were fights involved? I mean, did you have any pilot friends or anybody tell you about that?
No, I didn't, but I've read all the incidents about the incidents of when we tried to shoot things down, and I think we lost about 200 aircraft.
I remember Art once, a couple of years ago, was talking about an incident that he said he heard that involved a drilling project near 51, and he said they drilled down some 2,000 feet, and as they brought the drill up, it apparently pulled up human flesh, bones, and things like that. That's a bizarre story.
Well, that's, you know, the fact is this is just an experiment, a Petri dish, so to speak, and every 25,000 years, I mean, it's proven by historical geological records that every 25,000 years or so, on an average, the Earth is mixed up. It's turned on its axis, rotated on its axis, and everything is wiped off, and they start over again.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's slow down then. What?
I just want to tell you that I remembered the name of the MJ-12 member that had the crush on my mom. His name was Hoyt Vandenberg, General Hoyt Vandenberg.
Vandenberg.
And he was the second chief of staff for the Air Force, and Vandenberg Air Force Base was named by him.
And as these MJ-12 members died, the rest of the group found somebody else to replace him, right?
Correct. Okay. And now there's 36 members.
Still going strong.
Yep.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. I'm having an interesting night tonight, aren't we?
It is, indeed. And where might we be?
I'm Jackie. I'm from, North Las Vegas.
Okay, Jackie, go ahead.
Okay. John, I'm hoping you can solve a 27-year-old mystery for me. Do you know what was going on in 1979?
Where?
Well, on Mars.
No.
Okay.
What was going on in 79 on Mars?
Well, I used to work at NASA during that time, and handling downlink telemetry, and one night on our video monitors while, you know, the little Viking rover was running around, I see two men in suits, not necessarily space suits. I mean, they looked protective, but they didn't look like the bulky things that, you know, our astronauts use. But they came over the horizon walking towards the Viking Explorer, and our vision got cut off. I didn't see what they did with it or anything else.
They were probably making repairs.
Well, that's why I was wondering if they were our guys or not. Cause
Do you know what kind of suits they wore? Pardon?
Do you know what kind of suits they wore?
They wouldn't have to wear very much. I mean, the atmosphere is... there's enough atmosphere to walk around without a spacesuit on Mars, same as there is on the Moon. I mean, there's not. It's like about 15,000 feet on Earth. Now, you can go through a 24-hour acclimatization program on the Moon, and you can walk around without a spacesuit. Same thing on Mars. You don't need a spacesuit. If they had one, it was just minimal.
Did you have any other witnesses there while you saw this?
Oh, there's about a... Well, out of the workers, there's probably about a half a dozen of us, because we were, you've seen the typical NASA things where they got all the monitors.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So you had a few people out there monitoring the monitors.
Yeah, you got about, the people that were up there, and then there's about a half a dozen of us downstairs, because, it was just maintaining the equipment, because if anything went wrong, we had to get it up quick so they didn't miss the telemetry.
You folks must have been amazed at what you saw.
Yeah, because, when we saw that and they cut off our video downstairs, of course, we ran upstairs and they've got almost side doors upstairs. They have those little windows. I don't know if you have you been there?
I have not, no.
Okay. Well, they got those side doors going up to the back, what we call nosebleed section in most stadiums and stuff. But anyway, you come up there and we could look through the little window in that because they had just locked the door and they normally don't lock it on us. But anyway, they just locked the door, and then they came, we saw some more on their monitors, and then they came over with some paper taped over the door.
They clipped it. Can you imagine
Jackie,
that, John?
I appreciate you calling and telling us that story. It is great, and it just confirms what's going on.
Can you imagine that, John? There they are looking at their telemetry, and they spot the monitors, and they're looking at the rover piece of it, and all of a sudden they see two human beings walking into the scene.
Yeah, absolutely. They were just like Mars Rover, cleaning off dust. They had their paper towels and Windex and cleaned off so it could receive the signals.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with John Lear on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, hello, Mr. Norrie and Mr. Lear. Nice talking with you.
Sure.
I'm sure my sister in California will be talking about this show tomorrow. My name is Cliff. I'm in Dallas. And... it's just one thing about the whole scenario here. I've been hearing about, we have these, the Hubble, we have the spacecraft and all these different things that we sent out into space. And I'm really, it boggles me to think that none of our spacecraft or our satellites or anything out there in space has ever been destroyed by any of these aliens, if they are. Maybe I know we have some that are hostile. We have some that are that are not so hostile. But, I mean, we're able to land on these different planets, and including Mars, and take off and come on back home to Earth. And I'm just really trying to understand how come we have it. Because if we land on Mars and there is life on Mars, wouldn't that be like an invasion or coming onto their land? Like if they come onto Earth.
Well, how would they perceive that, Mr. Lear?
No, we're pretty harmless, and I'm sure we have some kind of agreement. And by the way, there's not one Hubble, there's two. There's a secret one and the one that the public knows about.
Okay.
I didn't know that. I hope one of them exists after a while, huh?
Yep.
All right, thanks. So do you think we have shot down or they have shot down any of our satellites?
Let's see. Have they shot down any of our satellites? I don't know. There was the Russian probe that got the beam out of Phobos.
And that was zapped. Something happened there.
And some of our stuff has been zapped in Mars. But, of course, NASA tells some of it's zapped because they don't want to share any of the information. They said, whoops, it failed, and then they get the information without telling us what it is.
And it's still up there doing whatever
sure.
it's doing.
Sure.
I always suspected that sometimes,
same thing
too.
With Clementine when it went up to take those fabulous pictures of the moon, and then after it got done, it, went out of control and we couldn't get the pictures and da-da-da-da-da.
First time east of the Rockies. We'll go to you first. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George.
Good.
This is John from Springfield, Illinois, WTAX.
Yes.
Yeah, John, you're one of my favorite guests on the show. I'd like to tell you that.
Thank you. Now,
my question is, what percent of astronomy taught in our schools, like colleges, is actually correct in your mind?
As far as?
Totally correct as far as you're saying what's actually going on these on the planet surfaces and the atmospheres. What is your percentage that you think that is correct that's actually being taught in our schools?
Probably 5%.
Really?
The orbits are correct. But all the rest of the stuff, the composition of the planets and, what's on there and the gases that surround them, that's all BS. Okay,
is it because the professor probably just doesn't know, John?
No, he is mainline. I mean, to be a professor and to keep your credentials, you better toe the line.
Right.
And not be talking about anything strange.
Sure. Well, but what I'm saying is, though, I don't think he believes there's anything strange. A lot of these guys probably aren't in the know.
Yeah, well.
West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hi, George.
Hi, go ahead.
It's Richard from Lawndale, California.
Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on with John Lear.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
I used to work at your dad's company, Lear Astronics in Santa Monica.
Oh, really? Yeah.
From 91 through 99.
That was when it was Siegler, right?
Pardon me?
That was when it was Siegler, right?
Right. Then it went on to Marconi and BAE systems. But the owners went and called for a meeting in the conference room one afternoon. And I went in there, me and a coworker, we were the first ones there. We were waiting for the others to show up. And at the end of the table, there's a projection screen. Just went up on its own. And he and I looked at it, and we looked at each other, shaking our heads. And
what happened to the screen?
It just shot up by itself.
Well, maybe it just had a short or something.
Well, at the end of the meeting, I talked to my supervisor. We were talking about it. And he says, yeah, this was Bill Lear's favorite room. Had a tucked-in coffee machine, used to kick back in there, I guess.
Oh, that was John Lear's father's favorite room, you're saying?
Right.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. A little tidbit for you there,
yeah.
John Lear.
Interesting.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, Wild Card Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, take it away.
Yeah, this is Jeff. I'm a truck driver going across to Montana here.
All right.
I used to work at the Livermore Labs when I was in high school, kid. I was wondering how involved were they in these programs?
They were at the top. Dr. Teller headed Lawrence Livermore, and Dr. Teller was head of the UFO program.
Okay. When I was working there, I started out as high school. It was part-time. I they sent me down to the salvage yard, and we'd separate material down there. And there were several times that they would bring really strange stuff in there, and there would be like a group of men bring things into the salvage yard, and we weren't allowed to go over there until they were done taking what they needed out, and then we'd go over there and dismantle it and put like the stainless steel in the wiring and different hoppers so they could be recycled.
Yeah.
And I was just, you know, I know that there was a large underground complex there between there and Sandia across the street. But I developed thyroid disorder, and I was curious if there would be anything that could tie that to radiation lab.
Now, that's really interesting that there was a place across the street called Sandia. Tell me about that place.
Or it was straight across the street from Lawrence Livermore Labs is what they called it. I was in there in 70, 71.
And what was in Sandia?
I have no clue. See, I was only cleared to work at the Livermore Radiation Lab.
Okay, thanks. George, the reason that's so interesting is one of the ways they keep things secret is they name different projects the same name. For instance, Sandia was the original name of the operation there at Kirtland Air Force Base.
Okay.
And then Sandia is also the name of the secret runway and facility up at the Paiute Mesa within the test site. And then now there's another Sandia. So it's pretty interesting. They sure like that name.
So you'd be totally confused, whatever they were doing.
Right. If the Sandia comes up accidentally, you know, somebody would think, oh, yeah, that's just that place over there.
Right. And off they go. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the program. Hi.
Hello, George.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Okay, John, you're blowing me out the door. Listen, I talked to an engineer that worked on the capsule that fired up on the pad and burned up the astronauts.
Yeah.
And he said that the wiring on that thing was atrocious.
Yeah,
he almost lost his job over fighting them, that it wasn't fit to take off.
Right.
And I don't know if, you know, how many people knew that, but I think that's a plug against NASA for sure.
Yeah, well, the story is that while NASA didn't specifically cause that accident, they certainly were complicit in letting it happen. You know, Gus Grissom was very outspoken. As a matter of fact, only a few days before the fire, he had made the comment, this thing ain't going to the moon in 2 years. This thing ain't going to the moon in 10 years.
Yeah.
Because he was so disgusted with the workmanship.
So anyway, that's one thing. But another thing I wanted to say, I saw a spaceship go in front of the moon one night, and it had to be about 2,000 feet long. It was the hugest thing I ever saw in my life. And it was in orbit around the Earth, I know it was.
Yeah.
But the thing that blew me out the door was that the thing was so vivid, it was the vividness of it seemed like you could just reach out and touch it. Yet I know it was in orbit.
Was it one of those huge triangular-shaped objects?
No, it was a cigar shape, but it was pointed on each end.
I sometimes get some incredible calls, John, from people who are looking at a full moon and they see something go right past.
Yeah, this thing had a very thick body and pointed on both ends. So I know it wasn't space junk.
Okay,
know.
Thanks for the call. John, what do we hear about these large triangular-shaped objects?
Those are probably ours. And, you know, they show up every once in a while.
A lot of them are seen near military bases, so
yeah.
I'm beginning to think maybe there's a big hangar out there or something like that.
Yeah, well, once you get... Well, no, they're not hangar. Everything's underground now.
Everything.
Everything. And these neat landing strips they have, what they do is the pilots say that, you know, when they're landing, they're vectored by radar, and when they get to about 500 feet, that the runway unzips like a zipper on a purse, and it, in front of them is revealed the runway. They land on the runway, and an elevator takes them down, and then the terrain, whatever it is, desert or orchards or cotton fields or whatever, zips back up, and it just looks like a regular terrain. I remember a few years ago, two friends of mine, Jim Goodall and John Andrews, had a report of a 10,000-foot strip 35 miles northeast of Alamogordo, and they spent 2 weeks. They each got their vacation simultaneously and drove around the exact spot for 2 weeks trying to find that strip, and I couldn't find it.
You still flying these days?
No. Oh, wait, who's it?
You.
No,
Not at all? Not even for fun?
No, I retired 5 or 6 years ago, I had my pilot's license laminated, put on the wall.
Okay, all right. I thought you were still at least playing around, you know, part-time for fun or something.
No.
Okay. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is Mike from New York. How are you?
Good, Mike. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm just a little bit astonished about, if you don't mind, maybe asking one or two questions.
I'll give you one before the break. Go ahead.
Okay. It's just about asking, how have all the astrophysicists made mistakes about the planets, and how come all the astronomers that we have at SETI have not picked up a single transmission from all these inhabited planets? This is beyond the pale. It doesn't make sense, and this is not a personal assault. I'm asking you an honest question, how they've not picked up at least the serious people from SETI, the astronomers, the astrophysicists, got it all wrong, and not one has picked up a transmission. And I'll listen to your answer on the radio. Thank you, John.
Okay, take it away, John.
I don't know. It's as simple as that.
It just is. It just is. Okay, well, we're going to continue to take phone calls. We've only got a half an hour left with our guest, John Lear, tonight. So if you want to just jump on board, if you can get in, because I will forewarn you, the lines have been busy all hour. If you need to email me, that's simple, george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment. Final phone calls with our special guest tonight, John Lear, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your calls, but we're going to wrap up this hour again with the Lear disclosure. It is a classic, and I want you to hear it one more time. I also would like you to pick up the After Dark newsletter, where we'll send you a complimentary double copy of the After Dark CD, bumper music, ghost stories, phone calls to the show, a collector's item of $14.95 retail value. It is complimentary when you order the After Dark newsletter. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie, John Lear, and your phone calls. John, I'm going to play your disclosure project once again at the end of the program.
Okay, let me tell you a quick story.
Yeah.
It relates to you not being able to believe that there's people on other planets.
Okay, sure.
Bob, sitting with Bob Lazar, and I'm showing him the pictures of the buildings on the moon, and he's trying to make it out, and he says, you know, I'm going to kill myself if this turns out to be true. So I had him sign a statement, and I have it in front of me. It says, I, Bob Lazar, promise to kill myself if any of John's moon stuff is true. Signed, Bob Lazar, August 23rd, 1996. When I finally showed him enough pictures that it was absolutely obvious that there are buildings up there, I said, now, Bob, your promise is you promised to kill yourself. And so he signed the following statement. Dated August 5th, 1998. I, Bob Lazar, in return for not having to honor the commitment to kill myself, if any of John's moon stuff was true, do freely admit that the object in the crater Copernicus on the moon is a box which I don't know what is doing there. Signed, Bob Lazar.
I love it. I love it. Back to the phones we go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with John Lear. Hi there.
Hi, this is Al from Anaheim.
Hi there, Al.
Hi. Hey, John, some of the things you've said tonight have really piqued my interest, especially some of the stuff on the moon. It's not the first time I've heard. I've heard from a couple of other sources, you know, various things going on, including Felix Bach and others. But what really piqued my interest was this, what you said earlier about souls. They're harvesting souls or something like that. And I'm wondering how this, number one, how does this, is this some kind of an electronic or electromagnetic device or something that's implanted in order to get these experiences and record them, or is it something else? And also, how do you fit that into your idea of our own spirituality, or if we have such a thing as spirituality?
Well, that is our spirituality. It is a little, it's like a little recorder, smaller than you could imagine, and it just records everything, and it is zipped back and forth, and records every lifetime.
And would that account for, I know there's people that have done studies on, you know, weighing right after death and so forth, and does that have anything to do, perhaps have to do with that or not?
I don't know. I hear that, you know, end of your life, you see the white light in the tunnel. That's probably part of the program to make you feel good about everything. But one of the ways that I figured out where the souls were going is McMonagall, who was one of the original remote viewers, was tasked to follow a soul. And the Army tasked him. There was somebody who was killed driving south of San Francisco, and he followed the soul going towards the moon, and he said as we were getting closer to the moon, whatever it was, the soul was getting wrapped in something, and he kept hearing, this is not your place, you may not come any closer, to the point where when he got closer to the moon, he felt, McMonagall felt, that he would die if he went any closer because they didn't want him to follow to where the soul was going to.
Hmm. Very interesting.
And that's in McMonagall's book.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you.
All right, Al. Thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. First time caller line, we'll get you in. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hello, Nighthawk. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
This is Rick from Des Moines.
Go ahead.
WHO.
Rick. Yeah.
Mr. Lear.
Sir.
The previous caller, not this last one, but the one before the break, had mentioned SETI. And what I'd like to know is, private and amateur astronomers for the past 50 years have said nothing, have seen nothing, have produced nothing. And how come, why is that?
I don't know.
About anything that you claim.
Excuse me?
About anything that you claim. They have not seen, produced, or talked about anything that you claim.
Okay, what are you talking about? You mean about saucers?
I'm talking about anything that you have claimed so far.
I just don't have an answer for you.
Okay, the other thing is, if anti-grav has been around for 50 years, how come they, meaning the black ops that you're talking about, or however you want to word it, how come they can't give a little bit to the human race and say, here, this is for the betterment of the human race? Anti-grav, electric cars. I mean, why are we walking around like ants if all this stuff actually exists?
That's the big question.
That's a good question.
What's the good answer?
I don't know what the answer is.
Okay, Mr. Lear, the last thing is, you talk about stuff and people's eyes glaze over. They glaze over because of the last two answers you just gave me. You have no proof of anything. It's your word. And you know what? Mr. Hoagland has started to disappoint a few people, including Art Bell, by talking about weather manipulation, and now he's siding with you. And this whole thing is getting a little ridiculous.
You don't believe in weather manipulation?
Sir,
the Chinese.
I don't believe in anything.
Hey. The Chinese just had it rain almost an inch over Beijing.
Oh, come on.
Last
week. Silver eye.
Well, isn't that weather
manipulation? I'm talking about with.
Isn't that weather manipulation?
Okay, I'm talking about hop. You know what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about chemicals. I'm talking about what Hoagland believes moving a hurricane. You're going to do with silver cyanide?
Iodide.
Whatever. Are you going to do it with that?
Not with that, but who knows what they have?
Apparently you seem to know what they have since 1962. Hoagland was Conkright's big buddy in 62, and you're telling me he didn't know anything? You're telling 10 million people a bunch of crap.
Well, and that's the word that gets you tossed off the air. God, see, he doesn't have an open mind, John.
Well, yeah, I don't have an answer for that.
We've got time for just a quick one before we take the Lear disclosure. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast, but it is lively. I like that.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, this is Steve from Oklahoma City.
Steve, about a minute for you.
Mr. Lear, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm a pilot and flight instructor, and my question is this. For years, I've been teaching my students that Bernoulli's principle is what creates how the wing creates lift on an airplane. And I had an aeronautical engineer one day come up to me and say that was that wasn't accurate. All the textbooks were wrong. That Bernoulli's principle really only accounts for about 10 or 15% of lift, not 75 or 80% as the textbooks say. And he'd been trying for years to get that changed. And I've seen some stuff on the internet that kind of collaborates what he said, but when they try to explain how the wing really generates lift, it's kind of above my head.
30 seconds, John. I got to cut him, but can you give him a quick one on that?
I've heard that argument, too. It's interesting. I'd like to know what the answer is.
All right. John, I'm going to play your Disclosure Project. You can listen to it at home if you want. No sense you hanging on for 10 minutes here. And first of all, I want to thank you for an enlightening, fascinating discussion.
Okay. It's been great talking with you, George.
All right. That's John Lear. It is an interesting one. I'll tell you that. I'll be back in a moment, but first, let's let you listen again to the Lear Disclosure, 2.5 years old, when he was talking on Coast to Coast AM about what could be.
Okay, let's say the government chose me. They were going to use me as an outlet to release this information. Let's just say they did that and they took me to a briefing. Then what, John?
Okay, we whisk you to, or they whisk you to Washington, D.C. You get limoed to this building, beautiful building. You go up into this room. They say, Art, you're the guy. If you give us the go-ahead, we're going to release everything we know to the public. And if you decide to go ahead, all major networks will be provided with information on all aspects of the cover-up. No type of information will be withheld because of the deal for immunity for all participants of the cover-up provides that nothing, no artifact, no piece of information be withheld. So here's what happened, Art. And, of course, this will call, we'll use some videos and stills. Our first UFO recoveries were in the late 30s. We made a couple in the beginning of the 40s, and then came Roswell, which the public found out about. We got two live aliens from Roswell. One died shortly thereafter. One lived until 1956. And we found out that so far there are 18 different alien species that we know about monitoring Earth. Some are good, some are hostile, most are indifferent. We found out that we are the experiment or product, if you will, of an alien race who we never met and really don't know who they are. All we know is that the Greys are cybernetic organisms, glorified robots, if you will, who work here at the behest of their employers, monitoring us through abductions. We were never able to find out what the experiment is all about, except that we have been externally corrected about 65 times, and they, the aliens, refer to us as containers. There has been speculation that the souls our bodies contains is the reason for the experiment, but nothing has been proven or determined. Since 1938, we have lost over 200 aircraft to UFO hostilities and thousands of soldiers in all kinds of different kinds of action with aliens. Since that time, several hundred thousand civilians have disappeared with no trace. Several thousand were eliminated by us because of their chance encounters with aliens, which we could ill afford to have publicized. A slightly more frightening phenomenon known as human mutilations have occurred on a regular basis and are similar to the cattle mutilations in that the humans or humans are taken from the street, so to speak, and returned to the same area about 45 minutes to an hour later, with their rectums cored out, their genitals removed, their eyes removed from their sockets, and completely drained of blood. In all cases, it appears that the mutilation procedures occurred while the persons were still alive and conscious. One of our scientists speculated that apparently the human specimens had to be alive for the samples to be worth anything. Abductions occur on a daily basis throughout the United States to at least 10% of the population. And when we first became aware of this, we protested to the little gray being that we held in the captivity at the YY-2 facility at Los Alamos, but a deal was struck that in exchange for advanced technology from the aliens, we would allow them to abduct a very small number of persons, and we would be periodically given a list of those persons abducted. We got something less than the technology we bargained for and found that the abductions exceeded by a millionfold what we had naively agreed to. In 1954, President Eisenhower met with a representative of another alien species at Muroc Test Center, which is now called Edwards Air Force Base. This alien suggested that they could help us get rid of the Greys, but Eisenhower turned down their offer because they offered no technology. At this point, it became apparent to all involved that there was no such thing as a God, at least as the public perceives God. Certainly some kind of computer recorder stores information, and an occasional miracle is displayed by the aliens to influence a religious event. So this so unnerved Eisenhower that he had in God We Trust put on paper money and coins and put into the Pledge of Allegiance to reaffirm the public belief in God. Shortly after this, it was determined at meetings between the U.S. and Russians that the situation was serious enough that a Cold War should be manufactured as a ruse to divert attention of the public away from UFOs and towards some other scary threat, the H-bomb.
Wow.
It was also decided to keep the ruse secret from any elected or appointed official within both the U.S. and Russian government, as long as it took so long to vet these officials, and the ruse was easier to manage if the top people didn't know about it. In the late 1950s, NASA was formed to compartmentalize, containerize, and sanitize information from all space platforms and vehicles. We sold NASA to the public, claiming that all information would belong to them. Actually, they got very little, and even that was highly sanitized. Our first efforts were to keep the public from learning about Venus, and that it's a similar planet to Earth, and that its population is very similar to us, but more technologically advanced. We have learned a lot from them. Starting with the Russian Venera 1 and U.S. Mariner 2, we made Venus look like a lead-melting volcanic surface spewing sulfuric acid into a pressurized atmosphere 90 times that of Earth. And was often the case we overdid it and wondered why no one ever asked how a parachute survived a descent into 800-degree air. We set up operations in Pine Gap, Australia, to preclude any prying eyes trying to figure out what we were up to. We regularly eliminated, through extreme prejudice, anybody who was part of the operation and made the least little tiny threat about disclosure or satisfaction with the operation. Any space mission that included Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Mariner, Voyager, Clementine, and all the rest, all data initially came transmitted to Pine Gap, and then it was relayed to JPL or wherever after the sanitizing. We had a little trouble with amateur radio operators, but we figured out when they figured out how they could intercept these signals, but we managed to deal with that. When the Russian threat began to fade, we introduced Vietnam, which kept the public occupied for over 10 years. The cover-up and the personnel to run the operation began to get bigger and bigger and required more and more money. We were forced to inflate the defense budget, which soon was not enough. Then we got into the drug business, which was still not enough. We were the ones that looted the savings and loan industry and Wall Street to boot. It is so out of control now, most people want immunity and want out. But there is so much secrecy and so many double and triple blinds in place that it is unlikely that this thing can ever be dismantled. And even if you give us the go-ahead to spill the beans to the public, it's unlikely they will get anything more than, yes, we recovered a flying saucer, and yes, there was an occupant, but that's all we're going to tell you. So go ahead and roll the tape for Mr. Bell. What you see here are the human mutilations. Look like that one was a male about 27 years old. Now that film is of dead aliens being pulled from the wreckage of their craft that crashed in Elantra, California in the 50s. That craft you see over there is was over 250 feet in diameter and had to be buried on the spot. That site is in Utah near Dugway Proving Grounds. The object that you're looking at now is the Keksberg Acorn, which was brought to Wright Pat in the middle 60s. There's Frank Drake trying to force information out of a being tied down to that stretcher. He was supposedly from Tau Ceti. These pictures you're looking at now are the structures on the moon. That's the tower in Sinus Medi. It's over 7 miles tall. And that thing there is what we call the Colossus of Agurum in Mare Crisium. We don't know what it does, but the machine itself is bigger than Brooklyn, New York. Now, those are videos of the domes covering the craters. You can see that some are in a very advanced state of decay. Now, these are five-second slides of the 18 different alien species we are looking at. That one there is the most gruesome-looking. The guards at one facility are carefully indoctrinated over a period of several months, being shown pictures similar to but not exactly like the alien. Only when they have been acclimatized, so to speak, of the horrible-looking beings are they allowed to stand in security positions. Before these acclimatations were done, we had two guards die of a heart attack as these aliens came down the hallway unexpectedly. And this last clip is of the Kennedy assassination. You've heard of the second gunman theory. Well, this is the second camera that recorded exactly what happened. We had four gunmen. And the bottom line was Kennedy had to go. He insisted on releasing what little alien information we had told him about. And he was trying to withdraw troops from Vietnam, which we were using as a diversion for the public. After Kennedy, we never told any president anything. Nixon knew because he was briefed as VP in 1952. That's how he knew where to take Jackie Gleason to Homestead Air Force Base to see the alien bodies we had storage there. And that's about it. Well, there you are, Bill. Can we brief the public? Yay or nay?
Yay or nay? Pretty astonishing stuff, huh? For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.